Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why a proposal in the Arizona legislature is drawing comparisons to the German Autobahn.
And we'll hear our next second act with a graphic designer who became an ER nurse.
But first, 2025 was the third hottest year on record. That sobering statistic hit the news this week from the World Meteorological Organization, which said last year continued a trend of, quote, extraordinary global temperatures. Here in Arizona, 2025 was our second hottest year on record, with 122 days above 100 degrees and higher nighttime and winter temperatures as well. So we know climate change is making the weather more extreme. But how is it affecting our bottom line? Well, our next guest this morning has an answer. Derek Lemoine is a professor of economics at the University of Arizona and co-director of the university's Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. And in a new study, he crunched the numbers and found climate change has reduced income in the U.S. by 12%. I spoke with him more about it, beginning with some context for that 12%. How big of an impact is that?
Yeah, so 12% is the kind of income impact you'd expect from sort of big policy changes that you might think about. Like, let's say big changes to immigration policy are often estimated to have an impact of that size. And we're seeing an impact of that size already from the climate change that's already here. And that's an ongoing impact that's going to be year after year. So climate change is like a really big type of policy that is, you know, hurting income instead of trying to help income.
Were you surprised by the amount here, by that big picture number? Did you expect more, less?
I can't say that I had a strong opinion about what the size of the number would be. I'm more surprised where it came from. Mm. And so I would have thought that what would drive losses would be it's hot where you live, or it weather's whatever it is where you live, and the weather's going to affect your productivity and it's going to affect the income where you live. But that's really not what's driving the number here. The effects of local weather on your income, that amounts to less than 1% of U.S. income. If we just kept it at, like, climate change changes weather where you live today and doesn't do anything else.
Right.
It's when you broaden the picture to recognize, to some extent, the climate change's impacts are persistent on weather. You know, weather's different year after year. But the big one is that climate change changes weather everywhere around the country at once. And once you account for that, that climate change is widespread and also persistent, that's when the number jumps up from 1% to, you know, it's uncertain exactly how big it is, but something on the order of at least several percent, if not even 12% or more. And That's what I didn't expect, that it was about the weather everywhere else that affected your county, not just about your own county's weather.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Okay, so let's back up for a moment and talk about how you did this, Derek. Like, how do you measure something like climate change's impact on the economy? This did come down to kind of very local data, right?
It did. We're often limited by the data we have. And so the data we have in this case are data on U.S. counties' income going back several decades. And so what we can, there's two steps. We need to know how climate change affects the weather, and we need to know how weather affects income. So for how climate change affects the weather, we have for many years now, the climate scientists have been developing physics-based models of the global climate system, and they can simulate them with and without climate change. With human-contributed greenhouse gases and other factors, they can replicate recent temperatures pretty well. Without all that, they get more of a flat temperature trend. You wouldn't see much global warming if it weren't for the human contribution. That's one of the reasons we know where climate change comes from.
Right.
So I basically leave that to the climate scientists to figure out what the weather would have been in the absence of climate change. You think about it as approximating what was the weather in the first half of the 20th century and compare that to what the weather is today. It looks something like that.
Yeah.
And the other side where really I'm bringing the economics to it is thinking about what that change in weather is going to mean for the economy. And so what economists have been really interested in and almost exclusively in the past is projecting the future impacts of climate change. Like, and that's a very different society, very different scale of warming and all that. And here the question's simpler, like, hey, let's just see what's happening today with the data we've already got and the economy we've already got. And let's start there. And then if we can't do that well, we're certainly not going to do the other thing very well. The weather everywhere else is going to matter through what we would call generic equilibrium channels. So what weather everywhere else can matter by affecting trade between counties. It can also matter, like maybe you're looking at weather elsewhere in the country and updating your beliefs about climate change and then changing your investments in your county locally. So we can kind of account for all these sorts of factors. So with data, you can basically say if a county has a year that's, let's just say, for example, hotter than average, it's got more hot days than average for that county, how does that county's income change? Does that county's income tend to go up or down? And then from that point on, it's just statistics. Different days of different types, cold, cool, warm, hot, have different effects on income. You then know how climate change affected weather, and then you bring the two together and you get the climate effect of climate change on current income.
So let's talk about what this might look like in real life, right? Like, how do you think climate change is impacting people's personal income? Like, it's probably a million little ways, right? When you're talking about the weather.
I think that's right. There's a lot of previous work now that's looking at the effects of weather and all sorts of different outcomes. And usually there is an effect. I mean, the weather's been shown to affect labor productivity. It's been shown to affect crop yields. It's been shown, I mean, I think it's fairly obvious we grow crops in the weather. It's been shown to affect capital productivity. It's been shown to affect time use, like what do you spend your time at work or at recreation or even other options. So there's a whole host of things. Mortality and health are also directly affected by weather. So there's a whole host of things that are affected. And I'm kind of like, looking at the all-in effect on the bottom line without being able to decompose exactly where that's coming from. I think the interesting thing for me is why is it that weather everywhere else matters so much? And there, I'm limited by the data we have. As it is, I can say with some confidence that I do think it's trade and not this effect of like updating my beliefs about future climate change. And so imagine that you're a farmer in Iowa, and so you get hit by a randomly hot year. It's bad for your corn crop. So it's too hot for corn, basically. Your yields go down. That's going to be a negative income hit for you. That's going to show up in the data as an income loss in a more agricultural county. However, if everybody else in Iowa and throughout the Midwest also has hot weather, then everybody's yields went down. Prices of your output of corn are going to tend to go up. And so your income might actually be higher. But corn is an input to all sorts of other things. I mean, not only do we eat it for food, but it's an input to all sorts of production processes, including livestock. And so all these other sectors are now going to have a more expensive input, and those sectors are spread all around the country. And so those income effects start getting, or the effects on product production and prices is going to start getting spread out through all sorts of different sectors and all different locations, and affect people even where who aren't living in Iowa or aren't even living in the Midwest.
You've got the ripple effects mapping out there.
Exactly. Things are very tightly connected. They'll stay local.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let me ask you lastly, Derek, about, I guess, the flip side of this. Like, I wonder, you also run the U of A's Consortium of Environmentally Resilient Business, right? Like, there's got to be an upside here if you're looking at an opportunity, at least, for an upside in addressing climate change for businesses. Like, I think the whole clean energy economy, the green economy, right? Like, is this going to balance out at some point?
I think it's a great question. Like, what would this mean for day-to-day operations? So on how we adapt today, I think there is an interesting upshot that we tend to think of. So adaptation is what we refer to as the process of, you know, sort of getting better at living with certain kinds of temperatures and a certain kind of climate. Like, you might install air conditioning as one common example. We tend to think of adaptation as being protection against a physical weather risk. And here I'm just looking at temperature, not disasters or anything. And, you know, we can all think of all different ways we adapt to temperature. But what I'm showing is that a lot of adaptation needs to be to the effects of climate change, not just the physical weather risk where you live, but to the effects of climate change on your supply chains and products that you would purchase and coming from weather elsewhere, which isn't the kind of adaptation that we tend to just knee-jerk think about. So it's not just about building a seawall or installing air conditioning in your current location. It's also about your whole supply chain is going to look different as a business. And the cost of everything you want to buy, some things could be higher, some things could be lower, but everything's going to change. And it's being resilient to these sort of broader effects in your inputs, and not just to the weather outside.
A tiny silver lining to end on, then we'll leave it there. That is Derek Lemoine, professor of economics at the University of Arizona, author of this new study. Derek, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Really appreciate you having me. Thank you for your time too.
State lawmakers this year may debate making Arizona the only state without speed limits on some highways. A proposal from Republican Representative Nick Cupper would, among other things, set up a pilot project on a stretch of I-8 between Casa Grande and Yuma as a de-restricted speed zone for at least a year. If that proved to be successful, ADOT could then do away with speed limits on other stretches of rural highways in the state. This has led to some comparisons to Germany's Autobahn, one of the only roadways on Earth that does not have a speed limit. The highway system is famous for its high speeds. Tom Zeller is a professor at the University of Maryland and has published books on the history of transportation in the U.S. and Germany. He says it's not for him to have an opinion on the bill in the Arizona legislature, but he does say it's worth thinking about its potential outcomes and what public health and safety engineers think about it. He joins me to talk more about all this. And Tom, am I right, first off, that you have driven on the Autobahn?
I've driven on it many times. First, as a kid, when I grew up there in Germany, there was very often a frightening experience to be passed by all these cars that were bigger and faster than my parents' car. Then I got a driver's license, would drive there myself on the Autobahn. Moved to the U.S. 27 years ago, and so I do visit pretty often and do not relish the experience of getting off the plane in Frankfurt or Munich and being jet-lagged and going to the car rental counter and getting my car and then being out there with all the other people who want to go really fast.
Well, yeah, so what is it like to, maybe not right when you're jet-lagged, but like when you're sort of at full strength, like what is it like to drive and know that it doesn't really matter, like no one's going to tell you you're going too fast?
I mean, comparing the two driving styles, I would say that in Germany, and especially on the Autobahn, right, drivers then tend to be much more alert. They have a different expectations of driving skills of the other person. And it's a more tense kind of experience, right? Because you want to pass a slow truck that's in the right lane. You're moving over to the left lane. Sometimes there's just two or maybe three lanes on the interstate highways. And, you know, while you're accelerating, right, there could be a big Porsche or BMW or Mercedes behind you that's going 20, 30, 40 miles faster than you do and then, you know, has to slow down because of you. And so that it creates a different kind of environment than, you know, driving in the U.S. where the idea at least is a steady flow and most people going at the same speed.
Is it too simplistic to say that going at a particular speed or not having a speed limit is safer or more dangerous than the other?
There's been a lot of research on these issues. And I think what most researchers have agreed on is that when most drivers are going at approximately the same speed, the risk of accidents, of injuries, of fatalities is lower. Having said that, if you look at the statistics, right, in and of itself, the Autobahn is one of the safer spaces to be on in terms of like the statistics of being involved, the chances of being involved in an accident. But that has a lot to do with the fact that you're only surrounded by other automobiles and trucks, whereas, you know, if you're in a city, there's pedestrians, there's people on bicycles. It's a much more diverse environment in terms of like who's participating in traffic.
Do you find that when you're driving on the Autobahn that you are going faster than maybe you would otherwise or maybe even than you feel comfortable with in an effort to keep up with the drivers around you?
I think that happens quite a lot, right? You want to go with the flow and the flow tends to happen at a much higher rate than it does in the U.S. I should also add that there's no general speed limit on the Autobahn. But if you drive in the vicinity of big cities, and especially during rush hour, they have what they call variable speed limits. So you have these giant overhead signs over the freeway that tell you how far you can go. And so during rush hour, sometimes you're only allowed to go at 40 or 50 miles an hour just to, you know, make sure that traffic is still flowing at least a bit.
Yeah. How did it come to be that there's this highway in Germany that essentially does not have a speed limit?
Right. So Germany is the only place in the developed world that does not have a general speed limit on its interstate highway. So it's a peculiarity, right? It's odd in the context of other countries. And what I've found in my research is that the lack of a speed limit on the Autobahn is really an artifact of the Cold War. So in the 1950s, right, when West Germany became part of the Western Bloc, became an ally of the United States, right, in NATO, there was a debate over speed limits on roads and regulation in general. And it took on an almost philosophical kind of quality and dimension in that legislators compared West Germany both to East Germany, right, the communist part of Germany, and to the Nazi regime. Both of these countries had imposed or did impose speed limits on roads. And so West German politicians thought that if West Germany wants to be part of the Western world of, you know, the world of freedom and individual liberty, they should abolish speed limits on all roads, which they did for the first half of the 1950s. And the results were horrendous, right? So many people got killed, so that they had to reintroduce a speed limit in cities, on general highways, and the Autobahn was exempt from that and then has stayed exempted. There have been many, many efforts over the last 70 years to introduce speed limits on the Autobahn, but they've never gone anywhere. And a lot of observers sort of comparing the U.S. and Germany, right, have noted that driving fast on the Autobahn is almost the equivalent of gun rights in the United States, right? So it's an issue that's very popular among many people, but it's also very controversial.
Well, it's interesting, and you just referenced it, the fact that so many folks in Germany see it as a freedom issue as opposed to a transportation issue or a safety issue or a fuel efficiency issue or any other kind of issue that a lot of folks might see speed limits as representing.
That's exactly right. So over the years, right, there have been many safety experts who pushed for speed limits on the Autobahn. In the 1970s, when gasoline became very expensive, very suddenly, there was a speed limit that was introduced for a little bit. That was not popular at all. In the 1980s, there was a major debate over air quality and air pollution. And again, there were efforts to introduce a speed limit. And again, that went nowhere. Just a few years ago, there were some rumblings among politicians about introducing a speed limit. But up to this day, it really hasn't happened yet.
Do you get the sense that Americans also look at speed limits to some extent as a freedom issue?
I mean, what I've seen looking at the 1970s and the 1980s, it was the rhetoric very much echoed what you had in Germany, right? So seat belts and speed limits were hugely controversial issues. The federal government in the early 70s introduced a 55 miles per hour speed limit to conserve fuel, right, during the oil price crisis. That did not sit well with voters. And of all the modes of transportation, right, if you compare driving to being on a train or being on a plane, it's the only motorized individual form of transportation, and people feel that they're in control, even though, right, the accident that they might end up in is caused by others or by road conditions or any number of reasons. And psychologists have been doing research on that, right? So that sense of control feels very important to a lot of drivers.
Tom Zeller is a professor at the University of Maryland and has published several books on the history of transportation in the U.S. and Germany.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a longtime Valley creative makes a career pivot to nursing.
I really did want to do something that helped people, especially helped people like on their worst day.
We'll hear the latest edition of our ongoing series, Second Acts.
But first, today marks the kickoff of the third annual International Atmospheric Water Harvesting Summit, hosted at ASU. Atmospheric water harvesting is an intriguing new frontier in water science. The idea is relatively simple. In addition to harvesting from rivers and recycling groundwater, what if we could tap into the water reserves floating in the air around us? Research into atmospheric water harvesting is still in its early stages. Our co-host Sam Dingman spoke with one of the presenters at this year's summit, Carl Abadam, a PhD student at the University of New Mexico. They spoke via Zoom, and Abadam said the first challenge is figuring out how to extract water from the air.
There are different types of technologies for atmospheric water harvesting. We have fog nets. There are these things called desiccant-based technologies, which essentially it absorbs water vapor out of the air, and condensation-based technology. So think of like a glass of cold iced water where water will condense on the side on a hot, sunny day. That's essentially what atmospheric water harvesting is doing, trying to utilize the reservoir of water vapor in the air. There's approximately 13 trillion liters of water vapor estimated in the atmosphere, which is essentially six times the total combined amount of water in all of Earth's rivers. If we could tap even just a small percentage, not even a full percentage of that reservoir, it could really serve a lot of people around the world.
So can I ask you, and I apologize if this is a really basic question, but you described fog nets. And if this were to be broadly implemented, what would this look like? Is a fog net a literal net that you would put up in a place where there's a lot of fog and then somebody would come by and take the net down? And
yes, so fog nets are more suitable for really, think of like high in the mountains or where there's a lot of condensation. There are lots of different devices, all the way from the laboratory bench scale, from like little tiny devices different researchers are fabricating, all the way to like really giant industrial size atmospheric water harvesters meant for like HVAC. You know, just I think the last conference, there was a marketed atmospheric water generator meant to be put in your home, like in your kitchen, collecting water around your home and that you could drink. So there are currently a huge range of what these devices look like.
And how much does water that is collected this way need to be treated before it's potable?
It really depends. And we have research going on that looks at the water quality based off of where you sample. So we have one site that's an urban site characterized by high vehicle traffic. You might be able to capture how does the exhaust smoke affect your water quality. And the other side of town, we have an industrial site. This is where heavy manufacturing goes on. There's agricultural farming going on here. And so you could imagine that the different characteristics and air quality between, you know, an urban commercial district versus a more rural industrial district, and how the different air qualities between the two might impact water quality. And from our research, we found that there is a statistically significant difference between water qualities.
If you think about traditional water sources, you need things like pipes and distribution infrastructure. Right. Is part of the promise of atmospheric water harvesting the idea that not only, as you pointed out, is it this massive resource that we could tap into even if we were only able to get a small amount of it, but is it also cheaper to capture and distribute?
Cheaper? It depends on what you're comparing against. We've also done research in our group, Techno-Economic Analysis by Natalie Gaioso. She looked specifically at the cost per liter for different harvesting environments. So in an arid region, a temperate region, and a tropical region. And she found out that the cost of doing atmospheric water harvesting in those certain regions could actually outperforms the cost of bottled water in certain cases. To speak on the pipes and the distribution network, I think that's also one of the main draws of atmospheric water harvesting is that you don't need to be on a municipal grid. Essentially, the idea would be you set up one of these devices. You don't need essentially that distribution network.
But also, I would imagine in parts of the country or the world where access to major urban infrastructure isn't available, this could be a meaningful alternative to get people safe water to drink.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So are you aware of any municipalities here in the U.S. or around the world where these experiments are going on? Like, are there people in the world currently who are drinking atmospherically harvested water?
I'm not sure about the drinking yet, because I think there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered regarding like water quality and also maybe pre and post treatment of this water quality. But there is a utility that I know of that we work with, and it's the Southern Nevada Water Authority. And they've deployed, I guess they call them atmospheric water generators on top of cooling towers. Essentially, you might have seen cooling towers, you know, exhaust water vapor out into the atmosphere for part of their cooling systems. And the idea is if you put an atmospheric water generator on these cooling towers, you can recapture that water instead of just letting it leave into the atmosphere. And so their application is really cool because it's not a drinking water application, but more of like a process type of industrial application, which is a really cool way to see other uses of atmospheric water harvesting.
So last question for you, Carl. Do you think widespread adoption of these technologies is something that's imminent, or how far off is putting this into practice?
I think there are still a lot of questions that need to be answered, especially if you're taking water out of the atmosphere, are you inevitably drying the atmosphere, right? Are you just dry? Right. Are you changing the weather? And we want to start working with government regulation agencies to start saying, like, are there water rights for the atmosphere? You know, and is that something, if there is an app, do those measures need to be put in place? And so this is like the Wild West of water right now.
Well, I have been speaking with Carl Abadam, who is a PhD student at the University of New Mexico. And Carl will be just one of the many atmospheric water harvesting advocates in town on January 15th and 16th for the third annual Atmospheric Water Harvesting Summit. Carl, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A recent survey finds more than half of healthcare workers nationwide say they plan to look for a new job in the next year, either within their organization or outside of it. The Harris poll also finds less than a third feel very valued by their employer or loyal to them. This comes as Arizona continues to struggle with a shortage of healthcare providers. The healthcare system itself is also dealing with changes, from Medicaid eligibility to rising insurance premiums to the role of technology like AI. With me to talk about what all of this means is Laura Mercer, an OBGYN in Phoenix and a member of the Arizona Medical Association's Board of Directors. And Laura, when you read the survey, what stood out to you?
Ooh, so there's a few things that stood out to me. I think one of the things that's perhaps the most striking is that there's a majority of respondents that have plans to do something different in the near future, not necessarily leaving medicine or leaving healthcare. I think it's important to note that the study didn't just look at doctors, didn't just look at nurses. It was really a sort of cross-sectional nationwide study looking at people who interact with patients in the healthcare space. And over half of them want to do something different, some of them within their organizations, some of them outside of their organizations. And to me, that means there's a lot of people that are not totally satisfied, not very content with where they are. And we might see some redistribution of folks. Maybe they don't leave healthcare altogether. Hopefully they don't. But there could be some shifting around, and that could lead to some gaps as we look ahead.
Does this kind of mesh with what you see in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, this study is not really a surprise to most of us in the healthcare community. It's something that we have been watching and a little bit worried about for more than a decade, maybe a couple of decades. Mm. Healthcare worker shortages are an ongoing threat, particularly in Arizona and other places where there are a lot of rural areas, rural communities, and we just don't have enough doctors, nurses, physical therapists, pharmacists, dentists, you name it, and we could use a few more of those here in Arizona.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you specifically about Arizona because we've had well-documented provider shortages for a while, and you're talking about maybe a redistribution. That sounds potentially kind of scary.
You know, it does. Also, I think it's important to keep in mind that this was a study that was nationwide.
Yeah.
And it could, who knows, be for the better. Maybe everybody says, you know, we've had enough of those hurricanes and we're all going to move out west. And we all of a sudden find ourselves very fortunate that we've recruited a lot of folks. I don't think we should hold our breath on that. And I think it's a little bit more likely that we see redistribution movement from folks in all kinds of spaces and in all kinds of locations.
How much do you think burnout is playing into this?
I think burnout plays a huge role. And that was one of the findings that they published in this study, is looking at overall that job satisfaction, what are the factors leading to people wanting to look for a different opportunity. And some of the obvious things popped up, salary, benefits. But there have been previous studies that have looked at how fulfilled somebody looks or feels in their job. And if they feel fulfilled, they're willing to tolerate lower salaries or a little bit less autonomy in their schedules or having to work always every Thanksgiving. I think there are a number of factors contributing to healthcare worker burnout. But certainly it's been a lot harder over the last several years. The COVID-19 pandemic really highlighted it and in a lot of ways brought it to the forefront and made it something that we could talk about and really helped destigmatize some of the mental health challenges that a lot of healthcare workers face. But overall, as we look at the current landscape in the United States and a lot of the distrust and misinformation that we hear about vaccines, about reproductive health care, about Tylenol, I think it's not hard to imagine why there are a lot of healthcare workers that are questioning, like, is this really worth it? Is this really what I want to be doing day in and day out?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You mentioned the pandemic, and it seems like we saw sort of a microcosm of all this, that like at the very beginning, you know, people were getting up on their balconies at shift change and applauding nurses and applauding providers. And then it seemingly very quickly, we were really questioning as a society, like, are you telling me all the information? Like, why can't I just trust Dr. Google? Like, why do I have to, you know, why do I have to even, you know, go see a provider? I can just do it myself. Like, it seems like within a very short amount of time, the public sentiment, at least in some quarters, kind of changed. And I wonder how much, like, was that kind of a turning point in terms of providers not feeling fulfilled and providers maybe feeling more burned out than they had prior to, say, spring of 2020?
I have no data to point to validate that. But anecdotally, what you said feels very real.
As a provider, what would you like to see from the employers to try to keep you and your colleagues doing what you're doing? Or at the very least, as you alluded to earlier, if, you know, if colleagues want to maybe do something different, still keep them in healthcare and not have them leave the field altogether. What would you like to see?
That is such a great question. And I think that the answer is complicated. I don't think there's any one solution that would apply to every healthcare provider.
Sure.
And I think overall, as we think about healthcare shortages, right, that gets even more complicated. One thing that I do know is that having shortages of permanent staff leads to the need to hire temporary, or we sometimes call them traveler or locum staff, mm-hmm. at much higher rates.
Yeah.
Along the same lines, just like any other sector of the business community, recruitment costs are high. And so if you're paying a premium for a temporary person while simultaneously needing to recruit and then train new people, kind of doesn't make sense. The calculus isn't there. So it seems to me that there could be opportunities for healthcare systems or other employers in the healthcare space to utilize those funds differently. One of the things the survey pointed to were educational opportunities or opportunities for growth. I mean, I think there's some real opportunities for healthcare systems to really look at, you know, how could we be engaging these really bright people, people that go to nursing school and medical school and pharmacy, like these are smart folks. How can we let those experts figure out how to best use tools like AI and probably 100 other things that we could sit here and brainstorm and think about to really improve their workspace so that healthcare workers can really focus on their patients instead of all of the other bureaucracy?
Well, so when you look at sort of the healthcare environment in the Phoenix area, let's say 3 years, 5 years out, given what you see on a daily basis, given what you saw in this study, what do you think it looks like?
Well, sadly, I think as we look 3, 5, 10 years out, we're going to see more and more healthcare worker shortages in Arizona. I'm an OBGYN, as I mentioned, and so, you know, I have a small bias towards women's and reproductive healthcare. And as I think about the maternity deserts that we have in Arizona, most places in our state have to travel more than an hour to access a hospital or birthing center that has labor and delivery birthing capabilities. I think as we look ahead, we know that we're projected to have healthcare worker shortages, something like 4,000 physicians and like 4,500 nurses by the year 2032. That's not that far. That's less than a decade from now. And those are big numbers, and it'll be hard to replace, you know, to fill that gap.
Hard to make that up.
Hard to make that up.
All right. That is Dr. Laura Mercer, a practicing OBGYN here in the Valley, also a member of the Arizona Medical Association's Board of Directors. Thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And now it's time for the next edition of our new series here on the show, Second X. Here we bring you stories of Arizonans who are starting over, maybe midway through life, maybe in retirement, maybe just as they're getting going. And today's second act took place right in the middle of Danny Newman's life.
Since 1988, I had been sitting at a desk in front of a computer, working with Adobe programs, making things.
Newman spent most of his career as a graphic designer here in the Valley. He told me he has always had a creative itch. Every day, he needs to make something.
Graphic design, even if it wasn't a client I was necessarily loving or a project I wasn't passionate about, at least at the end of the day, I made something. And making something out of nothing is very fulfilling.
But at a certain point in life, after decades in the business, something started to change for him.
I knew I needed to break away from sitting at a desk 8 hours a day. I needed to do something more hands-on, something more analog, not digital. I wanted to be a little bit more of a part of my community, too.
This, I realize, could go in a lot of directions based on those criteria. But it was all happening in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Newman was inspired by the nurses he saw acting as frontline workers running into the fire at a time when hospitals felt like dangerous places to work every day. He told me about it back on the show in 2022 when he came on to talk about his decision to change the entire course of his life at age 48.
The more I heard stories about the sacrifices they were making and the efforts that were involved in just, you know, surviving the pandemic, mm-hmm. I realized I wanted to be that person. Ah. I wanted to work with those people, not just because it's more active and more physical and more hands-on, but because and I know this starts to sound kind of corny, but I really did want to do something that helped people, mm-hmm. especially helped people like on their worst day.
Well, it's been 4 years since Newman started his second act, so he came back into our studios to tell me how it's going.
I may have overshot a bit. I want to do something more active. And I'd come home after my first, you know, few shifts as a patient care technician, realizing I had like tracked like 9 miles worth of steps,
you know,
in a day.
And you never sit down.
No, you never sit down.
You're not in front of a computer screen.
Yeah. No. Ask me about what the best sneakers are. Like, I'll tell you. Like,
yes, nurses know that best. Yes. And it's not like a creative field at all either. That's what really strikes me about this. Like, you talk about this creative itch you have and the ways in which you were trying to fulfill that all the time. I mean, this is not that at all.
No, it's not that at all. I was ecstatic when my managers first approached me asking if I would be interested in designing T-shirts for the department.
You're wearing
and
one. It's
I'm wearing one. And they did not know what was coming.
Right. So you're at St. Joe's. You're in the ED. And you've been there for a couple of years now. You're just about to graduate from nursing school. The first time we talked to you, you were just starting all of this. But you've been in the hospital for a couple of years now and been working in this kind of really probably stressful setting in the ER. I mean, I wonder, is it living up to expectations? What's it been like?
It really has. I mean, please don't get me wrong. There are days when I leave that place crying, wondering what on earth have I done?
Wow.
But that's only a way to let off a little bit of steam. Mm. Because honestly, it is everything I hoped for. I really got lucky because it could have, I mean, it could have been a huge investment and into something that, you know, into a huge mistake. But it's not been that. All of the things that I listed at the outset are there 100%. But that and more. I can't say it strong enough how much I love the people I work with. The team that I work with in the ER at St. Joe's is phenomenal. So even though I'm every shift, I'm walking into just chaos and panic. I know that somebody there always has my back. And at the end of the day, I can walk out of that place feeling like I was part of an amazing team.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I was able to help people to the best of my ability.
Yeah. So it's the opposite in so many ways. Like it's hands-on. It's, you know, face-to-face with people. It's life or death consequences, all of these kind of very high stakes things. I mean, there must be a million, but is there a moment that stands out to you, like a day, a patient, something that makes you, that really solidified this for you?
Oh, you really hit the ground running over there. I mean, from the very first day, I don't want to get too graphic or gory, but you do, I mean, you do see some pretty gnarly things working in a level one trauma emergency department. Obviously, some of the first codes that you work on in the ER are bracing.
Explain that for those of us who didn't watch a lot of ER.
a code is when somebody comes into the emergency department without a pulse.
Yeah.
And you are performing advanced life support in order to hopefully bring that person back to life.
Literally.
Literally bring that person back to life. And sometimes it happens, and that's an amazing feeling to be part of a team that was like pounding on this person's chest or administering epinephrine or administering a shockable rhythm, and that person survived. But sometimes they don't, and sometimes you have to put somebody in a body bag and put a toe tag on them, and I don't know. I remember. One of the first times I had to do that, and I remember putting a toe tag on a body and just noticing that this person had a brand new pedicure. And I started crying. I started crying because it hit me that this person did not wake up today assuming that this was going to be the eventuality. And that can hit really hard. And not that over time you become callous to those things. Maybe some people do, but you very quickly have to finish up what you're doing there and move on to your next patient. That none of that stops.
You're confronting death in a way that, I mean, most of us don't have to.
You are. And I don't want to give the impression that that's all day, every day. It's not. I mean, you're not dealing with that one after another, but you are dealing with sick, hurting, scared people all day long. That is for sure. And maybe to answer your original question, I think when I finally became a nurse after all those years of being a tech, and my one-on-one patient interactions started increasing. I mean, now it's my job to care and advocate for this person.
Mm-hmm.
I started to realize, like, oh my gosh, yes, this idea that I had all those years ago and is now finally coming to fruition, it was the right decision. I do pretty good at helping these people feel less scared and a little bit more comforted and for sure seen in a scary place and in a big confusing system.
Have there been moments you've doubted this decision?
Yeah. Oh, yes. There's been days all along, but there's certainly been some days in the last couple of weeks where I've left that ER, sat in my car for a minute and thought to myself, maybe I'm not cut out for this. And so I did have a day like that recently. And the next morning I went in and I was just keeping my head kind of held a little bit low. I don't know, just sort of bracing, like, can I do that again?
Yeah.
And somehow just this team that I work with, somehow they knew, or they were there yesterday and they saw it. And literally each of them sort of kind of came up to me low key and said, are you okay? I know you had a tough one. Like, I'm here for you and you can do this. And not every day is going to be like that. And within 15 minutes, I was like, okay, I'm ready for this again.
All right. Danny Newman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Danny Newman is a nurse in the emergency department at St. Joseph's Hospital in Phoenix, and he's the latest edition of our series, Second Acts. If you know someone who we should feature in it, send us a note. We are at the show at kjzz.org. Today's been a good day. Futures made and fortunes lost. As I'm standing in the lobby, waiting for the elevator to take me away up to 9 or 10.
That'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can find that at theshow.kjzz.org. And while you're online, you might as well follow us on Instagram as well. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. So I'm the last real thing.